UK Wine Show, show number 149. Bordeaux on Premiere with James Miles from LiveX. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 149 for the 27th of March 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with James Miles from LiveX. We talk with James about the Bordeaux on Premiere market. We go through the last 8 years of on-premier campaigns and look at how the market has changed over the last 8 years. Who's won and who's lost in the market. In the spotlight, we review the movie Bottle Shock. And since we're talking about trading fine wines, the quote this week, which is perhaps a bit of fun, is, "Music is the wine that fills the cup of silence." Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The European Commission plans to allow producers to make rosé wine by mixing red and white wine together, rather than be restricted by the current method of leaving crushed red grapes to soak with white grapes while they macerate. The EC believes that this specialist technique is holding back French, Spanish and Italian producers in new markets such as China. Blending of white and red wine is currently illegal in Europe, except in the Champagne region, where the base wine is blended to make pink champagne. But winemakers say that for still wines, it's sacrilege to simply blend the two together, and they fear the market will be flooded by poor quality rosé. The EU plan will be put to a final vote on 27th of April 2009. Meanwhile, here in the UK, rosé wine has replaced the wine box as one of the key grocery items that attract for the retail price index. Changes to the average shopping basket of goods, which is used to calculate retail price inflation, are made on an annual basis to reflect consumer trends. And as a broad rule, only goods that we spend at least £100 million a year on are included.
Have you ever noticed that rosé champagne is normally a couple of quid more than normal champagne, which makes the 20 to 50 mils of red wine added some of the most expensive wines about? But it's a bit surprising that the French consider this to be an inferior method. Something else the French have been adding to the wine that some people don't like is sugar. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, remember those 53 Beaujolais wine producers who were on trial for illegally adding sugar to their wines? Well, they've been found guilty and are to be fined up to €20,000 each, which is a much higher fine than the original demand by the prosecution of between €700 to €1,500. Although this process of chaptalisation, adding sugar to wine, is legal, the winemakers were found to have increased their alcohol by over 2%, which is the legal limit for the region. As well as the producers, three branches of the French supermarket chain Intermarché also received fines for trafficking the 600 tonnes of sugar. And the intermediaries who bought and sold the sugar received suspended sentences and fines. But the ruling was condemned as harsh by the local wine trade body Inter Beaujolais, who said it didn't take into account the winemaker's good intentions and the difficulties of the 2004 vintage. But it does highlight the differences in the law between different regions. For example, in Champagne and the Loire, in difficult years, producers can increase alcohol by 2.5 to 3%.
The reason Beaujolais is supposedly limited to 2 degrees alcohol is because they're in a much warmer climate. Champagne and the Loire, much cooler, so they need more chaptalisation. Fines for breaking the rules, irrespective of the so-called good intentions, is still wrong. I'm not sure what happened to the wine, but it should have been distilled, in which case the fine would be small beer compared to the cost of the sales of wine that they'd lost out. Speaking of cost of sales, Bordeaux's on-premier campaign is coming up fast, but the recession is piling on the pressure to Bordeaux producers. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, as the recession bites, Bordeaux's on-premier campaign is coming under pressure from British importers to reduce prices. The 2008 vintage will be released for tasting in France at the end of March before being bottled next year, and producers are still deciding at what level to release prices. Berry Brothers and Rudd say that top producers were considering bringing down prices by around 10 to 15% and were thinking of holding on to the stock until the economy improves. But Tom Mann of Bordeaux Index said prices would need to come down by half of the 2007 vintage. That's around £1,400 for a case of first growth. Meanwhile, Far Vintners, one of the biggest UK buyers of on-premier, have threatened to boycott next week's on-premier tastings unless the majority of Chateau halve their prices. Their chairman, Stephen Browett, says the strengthening of the euro against the pound, combined with the economic slowdown, has made buying 2008 Bordeaux a very unappealing prospect. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can read these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. With reports that many producers have not sold all their 2007 vintage yet, the likelihood of more wine not being sold must be worrying for some producers, especially the smaller ones. There's talk of producers starting to sell the 2007 vintage at a discount to the release price, which doesn't bode well, and the pressure must be piling up for those producers to drop their prices even further for 2008. We're going to be talking about the different on-premier campaigns and how prices have changed since release in our interview with James Miles coming up. But before we get into that, we've got this week's Spotlight, and this week's Spotlight is about the movie Bottle Shock. Bottle Shock is the latest movie about wine. Based on the 1976 Paris tasting, known as The Judgment in Paris, where Steven Spurrier arranged to taste a range of French versus American wines just to celebrate the American Bicentennial. The storyline centres around Steven Spurrier, played by Alan Rickman, going to the US in search of wines that he could taste against the best of France. It's also a story about the prodigal son and young Beau Barrett, played by Chris Pine, who quite literally fights with his stubborn father and their trials and tribulations. It has a weak love story that feels like it's been tacked on the side and really isn't part of the core story. But in the end, the redeemed son goes to Paris to oversee the tasting. If you don't know the results, I'm not going to spoil it, but let's just say the Americans do well. The acting in the movie is fine, if uninspiring, but the storyline is really quite slow, and I think only a real wine buff will enjoy it. There's quite a lot of names dropping about top chateaus in France, etc. as well, which, if you're not into wine, it must sound like a complete and utter waste of words. I enjoyed the movie, but I doubt if it has mass appeal that, say, Sideways has. It simply lacks humour and the slightly tongue-in-cheek, or maybe perhaps gum-in-cheek, that you need for mass appeal. In the end, I rated this an 82 out of 100. Next week in the Spotlight, we're going to be reviewing Oz Clark's Wine Atlas. How does Oz stand up against the other great wine atlas by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson? Before we jump into the interview, how are you getting on with the quote? Music is the wine that fills the cup of silence. It was said by a guitarist ranked 42 on the Rolling Stones magazine list of 100 greatest guitarists. That should give it away for most of you guys. Not. Born in Dorset, England in 1946, his work spans 50 years, working with such greats as Annie Lennox, David Bowie. Any ideas who said that? Pretty tough, I know, but I'll give you the clue after the interview. So next up, we have the interview with James Miles from LiveX, talking about previous on-premier campaigns from Bordeaux. Hi, I'm here with James Miles from LiveX. How are you, James?
Good. How are you?
Good, I'm very good. We're going to be talking a wee bit about Bordeaux and not so much, a wee bit about maybe the current campaign coming up, but perhaps getting some sort of perspective looking back at the last 8-9 years of campaign since you guys have been in existence.
Sure, sure.
Do you want to start off with, you guys, what, you started around 2000, didn't you?
We started trading in 2000, yes. So our first experience of a campaign was the 1999 vintage, which was launched in sort of the middle of 2000, so it's in June, July, as is normal for when the market starts to be actually launched.
What are the highlights of the first couple of vintages? Like 2000 is considered a good vintage. 03 was considered a bit hot, but I've had some really nice wines out of 03, so it's sort of quite interesting.
Well, the 2000 vintage was absolutely immense.
Volume-wise?
Yeah, in terms, because it was, critics clearly, and particularly Robert Parker, rated it extremely highly in relative to vintages in the recent past, and with hindsight, it actually came out at very low price, particularly in US dollar terms. So the secondary market developed early, and it just ran and ran and ran and ran, really for a period over 2 years. So I suspect that, you know, it was our top traded vintage for 2 to 3 years after release. So from a commercial perspective, it was a massive boon for the fine wine industry.
And you guys had just started, so it's a great thing to get your teeth into straight away.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, you know, because our type of platform, our type of trading does work extremely well in an en-primeur situation where people aren't necessarily listing a lot of the new vintage on their lists yet. No one quite knows what the right price is, and the market's only really just developing. And what happened in 2000 was there was immense demand for the vintage. And as a result, the vintage developed into the secondary market relatively quickly and started to trade at substantial premiums to the initial release prices, which basically meant that there was a lot of margin in it for the supply chain. And as a result, there was a lot of trade in it.
Yep.
And that price development just continued, as I said, for over a couple of years.
So what about, say, 2001, 2002 vintages there?
Well, 2001 wasn't a bad vintage, but it clearly struggled in light of what had happened.
Yeah. It's like everybody spent their money on 2000.
So yeah, but it was a reasonably successful campaign. It was much smaller than 2000. But the economy in 2002 was off.
The dot-com bubble burst.
Yeah, the dot-com bubble had burst and equity markets weren't particularly good. And so there was that. So for one point, on the one hand, it suffered from being in the shadow of 2000. And secondly, the economy was somewhat worse. And of course, in 2002, that was compounded even further because in 2003, the economy was in worse state still. And 2002 wasn't the vintage that 2001 was. And it was also a very small vintage. So as a result, actually, the really interesting thing about 2002 was that it came out at very, very low prices. I mean, the first growths were offered in the market at below £700 a case, which in hindsight was fantastically cheap to be able to buy first growths at £50 a bottle or not that much more than that. Mm. Is perhaps an event that we may never see again in our lifetimes. And even though everyone thought it, I mean, it wasn't a particularly successful campaign, but as it happened, if you'd had bought 2002s, you would now be extremely happy because they've gone up in price by four or five times. So.
Yeah, well, that's possibly maybe something to do with 2005 vintage, but we'll get to that. Yeah. 2003, quite a hot year. I really noticed the weather in the UK that year and I thought, fantastic year.
Yes, I mean, 2003 was... The honest truth is no one quite knows exactly how 2003 is going to end up turning out. It was such a hot year and it was quite a difficult growing season for the vast majority of Chateau in Bordeaux. But it did suit the vintages, I mean, the region, particularly the areas in the northern Medoc where typically they have problems in ripening their grapes.
Yeah.
And so some of the top wines made absolutely fantastic, probably freakish wines, which also appealed to Robert Parker's taste. And as a result, there were, particularly for the first growths, a high number of 100-point scores and very, very high scores. So
I remember Jancis and Robert being at quite different ends of the spectrum.
On things like Chateau Pavy and those sorts of wines. So there was definitely a big divergence of views. And it's clear that it was quite concentrated in terms of where the good wines were made. I think there were probably a lot of wines which perhaps won't stand the test of time. Mm. And in fact, outside of the Northern Medoc, you might find that there are quite a number of wines that perhaps fall apart relatively early. And that's the question mark over. I think, I don't think I'm being controversial in saying that. I think that's probably something that a lot of people haven't quite got their heads around yet.
Yeah. I've started drinking a bit of second growth and second label first growth. I don't drink too many first labels.
Yeah.
First growths that often, but they're actually quite drinkable now, whereas normally I'd be a bit worried about drinking them.
Yes. Well, I think that's the thing. They're likely to be early and early drinkers, and the question is, whether they actually stand up to the test of time, whether they actually go on to be
any good in 20 years.
Yeah.
What sort of things have happened to the pricing of maybe the 03 vintage? Because it obviously is a bit of an oddity.
Well, they came out at, for the top 25 wines or so, prices matched 2000 on average. So it was, they were record prices. Mm-hmm. And they came out at record prices. So again, there was some scepticism as to whether people were sensible to be buying them at en-primeur, and clearly they looked exceptionally expensive relative to 2002, which had come out very, very cheaply. So the year-on-year change was massive in 2004 when the 2003 came out. So yes, but it, as it turns out, you know, the first growths in particular did continue to appreciate in price. Apart from anything else, they were made in relatively small quantities, as against the 2000 vintage, of course, which was a much, much bigger vintage.
Okay. 04 now came out in 05, so what was there?
04 again was not a bad vintage, but slightly struggled in the shadow of 2003, and of course, even more so, being wedged between 2003 and 2005. So there are a lot of wines that have appreciated massively in price. They didn't come out at high prices, particularly in hindsight. And I think there was a lot of skepticism at the time as to how good the vintage was. And I think most people probably agree that it's perhaps a better vintage than they thought at the time. And I think there's still probably a lot of good value Bordeaux to be had from the 2004 vintage.
05 was the vintage of the century. It was only 5 years old that century, but...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think...
Let's face it, Bordeaux normally has a vintage of the century every year.
Well, I think they probably have a vintage of the century every 5 years and some indifferent vintages in between. That tends to be how it works out. But yes, I mean, 2005 was clearly exceptional for lots of reasons, but mostly for the prices that were charged, because... Yeah. We were all pretty amazed by the prices in 2000 and 2003, but 2005 came out at something like twice the price of those vintages. Clearly, that was absolutely phenomenal, and it was a reasonably big vintage.
I remember when it came out, a lot of people were squealing at the price, saying, "Oh, it's too high, you'll never get it away, it's really bad." They got it away, but the Bordelais were always talking about, "Oh, don't worry, you know, you may not buy it, but Russia and Asia will buy it, so that's not a problem. We don't care about you guys, are we?" But that's sort of the general impression I got.
Let's not get it wrong. I mean, the UK market is the most important market for en primeur, always has been. Probably, you know, probably always will be in our lifetime, simply because the concentration of very big merchants with a big claret history in the UK who are selling internationally. So by far and away, the biggest buyers of 2005 were London, was London. Mm-hmm. So yes, I mean, I would say that it was largely London that drove the price of 2005 rather than the new markets, because by and large, new markets don't buy on primeur anyway.
Yep.
So it was very much a market that was driven by the traditional London traders.
Do you think, because I got the impression that they weren't so happy about the pricing.
Well, they weren't particularly, but the demand was absolutely enormous for the 2005. And even though everyone was sceptical about the level of prices and a bit disappointed by lower prices, the first growth still went on and doubled, as did many other wines, up until the middle part of last year. So yes, I mean, even though there was a lot of complaints, the Bordelais do seem to have got it right. I mean, they probably think, with hindsight, they may have underpriced it because clearly a lot of money was made in the supply chain, a lot of money was made by the end user.
Yeah.
And of course, the other major effect that the 2005 had was to drag up the prices of all the back vintages, really.
You know, you had a step change in what people consider to be a good vintage from the 2005 vintage, which obviously does drag up other prices.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the 1982s went from sort of £6,000 to £10,000 for a first growth to sort of £15,000 to £20,000 for in the case of Lafite. And basically, I you know, most first growths and most top wines pretty much doubled in price over the course of the following 12 to 18 months after 2005s came out. And the bubble for 2005 really started to burst when Robert Parker came out in April 2008 and didn't quite give it the resounding round of applause that everyone was expecting, and actually didn't give nearly the number of perfect scores that the market was expecting. And as a result, prices started to trade off and have actually... since September-October time, when the credit crunch really started to affect the wine market, they have now come off quite substantially, and there are wines like La Mission Haute-Brion 2005, which have actually halved in price.
From release price or from the...
From their peaks. They're still substantially up on their release prices, but they have at least come down to earth with something of a bump, and probably now represent, taking a long-term view, very good value, because there's no doubt that these wines are some of the greatest wines that have ever been made in Bordeaux. That may not be true of the first growth, which have had some very, very great vintages in recent times, but for the second, third tier wines, probably made the best wines they've ever made. So you may well see a step change in the prices that some of those wines command relative to other vintages around, just simply because the third growth or fourth growth probably made second growth quality wines in 2005, and Cru Bourgeois probably made third, fourth growth quality wines.
Sure.
So as a result, there's still, I think, probably some very, very good value to be had in the second line wines of 2005.
2006, the Bordelais had decided they liked the money they were getting. Quality dropped a wee bit, perhaps. Prices didn't seem to change too much.
That's true. I mean, they were cheaper, obviously a lot cheaper than the 2005s had become in the marketplace, and clearly a lot cheaper than the 2003s or the 2000s have become. So, but they were somewhere in between those top vintages and the 2001s and 2004s, which were still in the marketplace. So relatively for a sort of also-ran vintage, or at least that's how it was perceived to be at the time, it did seem to be quite expensive. But it wasn't a complete...
I thought they released at the same price as the 05s, weren't they, or virtually?
The release prices were very comparable, but the reality is that the 2005s in the secondary market had more than doubled, had nearly doubled or gone up substantially on the whole over that period of time. So... it was still a successful campaign. I mean, it obviously wasn't anything like as successful as 2005, but there was still, the economy was still strong, there was still plenty of demand out there, and there were still some pretty good wines made. I mean, I think most of the critics would agree that it was much better than average vintage. And commercially, it was a success, I suspect. It was mostly sold through the supply chain.
Okay. And then the 07 vintage, which is the one that's just, well, not just got away, but it's the one that's the on premier campaign now.
The 07 is clearly a problem. I don't know whether the number 7 is fated, but clearly 1997 was a disastrous campaign. It got sold too expensively for the quality of the vintage, and subsequently a lot of people lost a lot of money.
What did the release prices of 07, what happened there?
Well, the 07 didn't sell nearly as well, and I don't think it wasn't bought either to anything like the extent of, say, the 1997 was 10 years earlier. I think people just decided actually the price was wrong, the quality wasn't there, and a lot of people didn't buy for stock. So I don't think you'll see anything like the kind of fallout in the international marketplace that you saw in 1997 when everyone bought it, and everyone bought it in quantity at the wrong price, and actually it was the supply chain that ended up losing the money.
Yeah,
I actually think that the 2007 didn't sell well, and therefore most of the losses that will be taken on 2007, or most of the likely losses, will probably be more concentrated in at the Chateau or within the Bordeaux supply
chain. So the Chateaus didn't get their 2007 vintage away at all?
Well, the top wines would have done, the very top names. But I think a lot of people, where they were able to, would have said, or they weren't worried about their allocation, would have likely said no.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because a lot of people are forced to take poor quality, expensive wines in the odd year to ensure that they get access to the 2005 vintages when there's money to be made.
Yes, there is an element of that. But I think that to some extent that the old status quo is slightly broken down. And, people do say no now more than they might have done in the past. Because I think you have to look at it in the context of the following vintage. People were able to look at 2008 and take a view that actually it wasn't going to be a great vintage, they would have known that even in June, July of last year. And so they were in a position, I think, to say, to be more cautious about 2007, okay, because they didn't need to build up an allocation to get 2008 which is slightly poison chalice, you know. And I suppose, you know, I think it's no secret 2008 is going to be a difficult vintage to sell. It's not a great vintage.
And when you say not a great vintage, in the scale of the last 8 or 10 vintages, where does it rank?
Well, I haven't tasted the wines, nor am I likely to taste them, actually. But if one looks at the weather patterns and the weather data, which we have done, it looks like the most difficult growing season we've seen in the last, well, certainly since we've been around, you know, for the last 8 to 10 years. So I think it will be a difficult vintage to have made a good wine. But you know, you combine that with a credit crunch, and it becomes a very, very difficult vintage to sell.
Yeah.
And I suppose more worrying for the people who own them, does expose the 2007.
Because prices are likely to dip away a wee
because,
bit?
Because, you know, there are people who say 2008 is better than 2007. I don't know whether that's true or not, but if that is the case, and 2008 does come out at much lower price than 2007, it does make the situation for 2007 quite difficult.
So the prices could erode from the 07?
Yes, yeah. But, you know, this shouldn't be a problem. I mean, you know, Bordeaux has had a very, very good run. The last 5 or 6 years has been a very, very profitable period for merchants, for Chateau, and on the whole, you know, balance sheets are extremely strong, and I think, you know, people can certainly afford to take a hit on a vintage every once in a while. It doesn't actually happen, you know. New Bordeaux vintages are very, very rarely a commercial failure. It perhaps happens once every 10 years, Bordeaux certainly is capable of withstanding that.
One of the problems with the négociant system or the on-premier system is that wines are priced and sold before they're bottled.
Right.
And then the wine's delivered years later.
Right.
And both parties have got to still be in business.
Right.
When that happens.
Yeah.
So there's obviously quite a lot of credit risk associated with these sort of things.
There is a lot of systemic risk in the system. And it would be really nice to see that problem addressed, because the wine market clearly has developed, you know, the on-premier system was fine 20 or 30 years ago when the supply chain was a lot less sophisticated. Clearly the supply chain has now become a lot more complex. And my own view is that it's unfair for the Bordeaux market to be placing so much risk on the supply chain when a much better system could be developed. And I don't think there's unfortunately, I don't think there's an enormous appetite to change that in Bordeaux, but it would be nice. We'd certainly welcome efforts to improve the risks that are inherent in trading.
How could those risks be managed? Would it be through an insurance scheme or...?
Well, that's possible. An insurance scheme is possible, although complicated by the fact that realistically on-premiers are passing through a lot of different hands. You know, in the 2 years between initially being released and turning up. So, you know, I think then there would need to be some form of clearing system within Bordeaux so that title could change prior to basically the wine turning up in your warehouse, which is the only time one can be sure of title with the current system.
Okay, so even if you've paid for it, you have no title to that wine. So if that company goes down, you're going to lose it.
There is a very high risk that you will lose that.
So even if you've bought the wine, you're still an unsecured creditor.
That's right. You know, in the eyes of the law, that's correct. Yeah, which is, you know, I think an unacceptable position for the supply chain to be placed in.
Why is it? Why has it gotten to that situation? Because I would have thought the purchasers would insist on at least having ownership of the product.
Yes, I mean you've certainly got ownership to the product, providing the counterparty that you purchased the wines from is still around when it comes time to deliver the wines, and is able to purchase the wines or buy them in if their supplier is no longer in the chain. So the only way that one can really be sure of it is to only buy from the most blue chip players and be absolutely sure that you're comfortable with the balance sheet that they're holding and that they're going to be around in, that they're strong enough to be around in 2 years' time. But
why
know,
is it? Why doesn't the money go into an escargot? Is it called an escargot?
An escrow.
Escrow. Escrow account. That's what you use in trading, isn't it? So that.
Yeah. No. I think. I mean, that could easily happen. But that's what I mean. You know, you need a clearing mechanism where title could be recorded, and it very much like, you know, the old fashioned share registry, for example. I mean, the Chateau could have a register. Could use a registrar to basically note who owns which case of wine. And whenever someone sells it on, they could notify the registrar that they're the new owner. And you know, and that at the time when the goods became deliverable, the Chateau would deliver to the details on the registrar, and that would actually work.
But that would increase costs for the Chateau because they'd have to manage that.
Well, it would marginally. There would be an expense involved, definitely. But in terms of what it would do, in my view, is it would encourage a huge number of new participants into the marketplace and make it a much bigger market. I think it would mean that the Bordelais would be the biggest beneficiaries of that, without doubt. So I think there's a huge upside from doing it for everybody. But I think, you know, there's clearly vested interests who don't necessarily have the appetite to make those kind of changes at the moment, because, you know, actually for most of the players, key players in Bordeaux, there's no great incentive to change the system because they're not being put at risk. You know, sadly, it will probably take a very big disaster before anyone takes it seriously. But one only has to look at what's happened in financial markets and to see companies that everyone thought, you know,
stable, safe.
Were stable and safe and would never go bust, and how many of those have got into trouble, to realise that this is something that could happen and should be addressed. You know.
Just before we finish up here, James, what's happened to the prices during the credit crunch? Money's obviously got tighter, pound dropped, and I understand a lot of European people came in and purchased wine in England, which may have kept the market up. But what's going on since October or so?
Well, we publish various indices which track prices, including the LiveX 100 index, which is very much viewed as the sort of industry benchmark for fine wine prices. And that
all over the world or just in the UK?
I think very much all over the world now. I mean, you know, the LiveX 100 is quoted in China, in Poland, in the States, all across Europe. So, you know, I think it's very much filled a big void for, you know, not just in wine, funnily enough, but actually as a barometer for luxury goods in general. And the index is down about 20% from its peak. And funnily enough,
when was the peak?
In June last year. And funnily enough, actually, January and February were up 3%. So,
what's the price? Is it priced in pounds?
The index is priced in pounds, as really wine is, to be honest with you, because such a large proportion of the market. Is secondary market is done in London. I think most wine prices around the world are benchmarked against sterling. So clearly, I mean, I think the point you're making, alluding to quite correctly, is that in some ways the falls have been flattered by the weakness of sterling. Yeah. If you look at prices in dollar terms or in yen terms or in euro terms, then, you know, they're down by 40% or more if you're looking at them in yen terms. So, and that's definitely helped the market because there's certainly a lot more exporting going on by the UK trade. And that's certainly helped out the UK vis-a-vis wine trade in other major centres around the world.
And just one question, Hong Kong, a lot of people have been talking about Hong Kong. Chinese changed their duties, etc., about a year ago, and people are saying Hong Kong's going to be the next big trading centre for wine, maybe servicing the Asian market. Do you see a lot of relationships developing between you guys and people in Hong Kong? Or are you seeing pickup in customers?
Well, we've already got, I mean, a large number of customers in Hong Kong and in the region. So that hasn't changed. What has changed is that a lot of the major UK traders have set up offices in Hong Kong, recognizing that it's an increasingly important part of their business. Mm-hmm. And they want to get closer to it and understand it better. So I think it has been an important contributor to our customers' income over the last few years, accounting for 25% to 30% in many cases of their business.
Okay.
Hong Kong, no doubt, will become an important centre for the region, as London and New York are currently. I mean, it shares many of the same assets as we do in terms of being a relatively open, free economy, you know, a well-established service centre with low taxes, and that's what Hong Kong's good at. You know, so I'm sure that they will be a very successful hub, and will only continue to do more business in that part of the world.
Excellent. All right, James, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with James. It's interesting that the release price of Bordeaux is a good bellwether of the world economic situation rather than the quality of the wine. Calls by producers for prices more aligned with pre-2005 watershed prices could see further softening in prices over time. This year is a significant year for ongoing prices, and I imagine the Bordelais don't want to see a return to pre-2005 prices. Those who bought wine in the last couple of years will become the biggest losers as prices reset. But a high price may cause quite a bit of harm to the on-premier market. So it's a very, very interesting campaign this year. Oh, the joys of Bordeaux. In next week's show, we finish up talking with James by looking at LiveX's Fine Wine Index. What is it used for and how can it be used? But before we finish the show this week, how are you getting on with that quote? Music is the wine that fills the cup of silence. Bit of a tough one. Not too many sure if anybody got that. But it's a great metaphor on wine and music, and it was said by Robert Fripp. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.